Okay, well today I'm going to talk about some STP converted waveforms, some preliminary work we've been doing underneath the South American subduction zone. I'm going to give you a little bit of flavor of what we're looking for, where we've already seen it, and what it could be, and then I'm going to show you a few examples of what we've done and what type of data we're using, and then just leave it at that. Right now I have a big ugly table which is not in a good format to show at a talk like this. So when we're talking about lower mantle reflectors, we're talking about non-standard seismic reflectors that are usually in the lower mantle. This is from my advisor, Family New, I believe it's still unpublished. The lines are blacked out here for the 410 and 660 because those have been well studied and there are many, many observations of them. This is just a histogram of how many observations we have of lower mantle reflectors. We have some in the 520, and then the lower mantle tends to be a little more spread out, and it tends to be, if you look at this data here, this is ERI, which is based in Japan, so we have a lot of this data here in the 920s from the West Pacific and the West Pacific regions. And this is the RJ, is the Ravenon Jordan from Ravenon Jordan, and others is just, the blue is others being just a mix of any other sites we found where they actually have lower mantle reflectors. Just an example of what we do see when we're looking in the West Pacific. We do see this. This is actually a high velocity zone. This is tomography from Fukao in 2001. Basically, if we look at this tomography and we look at these scatters, they tend to be associated with this high velocity. It's debatable whether or not it's in the high velocity or at the base of the high velocity, but we can say there is an association. And sometimes when we're really lucky looking at these things, these are very small amplitude arrivals. This is an example from this earthquake in the northeast quadrant of this map in the West Pacific that gets you coordinated. The Sumatra earthquake happened somewhere over here. This is Kali Mountain Island in the center. When we get some of this data, we do actually can see it in the raw data. This is just low pass filtered at 2 seconds, and you can see some arrival coming in right around 40 seconds here. And that's what we're actually looking for. Most of the time, you can't see this arrival in the data. It's because it's very small, and you have to actually pull it out of the noise. So what can these scatters actually be? One idea is that maybe we have some kind of lower mantle layering, chemical layering. This is actually from Wen and Anderson in 97, where they're actually proposing that, hey, we might actually have a chemical layer in the mantle. They actually place that at 920, and then this mantle layer would have large amounts of topography, which makes it hard to see seismically, so it might explain why we're seeing some of these rivals in the West Pacific, or I can say right now, South America. Another possibility is that this is somehow related to a slab. And basically, if we go take a slab to depth and it stays cold enough and it's thick enough, we can start getting some of these breakdown of the dense magnesium hydrosilicates at depth. And this is very dependent on the slab geotherm, but it's another possibility to say explain what we're seeing. So one of the reasons we're now moving to South America is we have the high velocity zone in the West Pacific, which could be a subducted slab. So if it is this, we should see something and if the slab geotherm in South America is right, we should be able to see something similar in South America. And we can at least say we have this association between subduction, high velocity anomaly, and possibly some of these lower mantle reflectors. So to look at these reflectors, what we're actually using right now is an STP conversion. This is just a cartoon of what the actual phase is. The phase we're looking at is S wave that hits some deep discontinuity, converts to a P wave, and then travels to a receiver at a teleseismic distance. On here, I also have the direct P wave, the P410P, and the S410P. Again, these are also phases we should see. One of the reasons to use this phase and deep earthquakes is that basically if we use a deep earthquake at a teleseismic distance, and this reflector is there and this phase is present, it should arrive between the P wave and the large the PP arrival. This is the P reflecting off the surface and then traveling to the station. We should actually see it between that arrival, which is actually very quiet for this type of earthquake. So it should be easy to pull this out as long as we have a good signal-to-noise ratio. This is an example of some of the data we're using. These are deep earthquakes in South America. We have a few more points in the center here and in the north and south as well now. These are just the focal mechanisms and the locations. Beneath this is Grand's S-wave model from the layer, I believe, starts at 850 kilometers depth. These black points here are conversion points. These are actually what we're actually sampling. We see the S to P conversion. This is the point where it actually samples in the map. The black points are for those in some events that we've recorded in the Southern California seismic array. And the red points are points that were recorded in the Capovolo array. Our data set has actually expanded at this point. We now have all the Pascal arrays in the United States that we can actually have data for. We've including the Ristra array, the CD-ROM array, as well as we also added in the Pacific Northwest array right from the University of Washington. And that data has been analyzed. I'm not going to show you much of that today because it's, again, in that big ugly table. So what do we actually do with this data? Well, first thing we do actually low-pass filter this data with corner frequencies at 1 hertz and 0.5 hertz. And then we also calculate a signal-to-noise ratio. In order for us to see these very small phases, we actually have to have a good signal-to-noise ratio. So we keep any station and earthquake radar that actually has a minimum size signal-to-noise ratio of about 2. Then we pick and align the P-wave arrivals, so all our slownesses and all our times are going to be now relative to the P-wave. And then we go through 4 different stacking processes with bootstrap resampling. We do a linear stack, an nth root stack, and phase weight stacking using both a linear and an nth root stack as well. So we have a linear phase weight and an nth root phase weight. And the bootstrapping is actually important, and I'll show you an example of that why in a few slides. So basically, instead of showing you an equation, I'm going to show you a cartoon of kind of what we're doing to get a vespagram, which is basically we have time and slowness. When we have this, what we're doing is stacking on some angles. As we change what slowness we're stacking on, it'll actually stack along a different line, going from negative slowness to zero slowness, which in this case, since we're relative to P, is parallel to the P wave, to a positive slowness. And then we kind of add this all together into a stack using these different methods. And we get a vespagram like this, which gives us some relative slowness to this P wave, because P's are zero, and versus time. So again, relative to the P wave. So P is zero, zero. And then we can go through and pick out these phases, kind of like fingerprinting. So this is an example from an event in the northern region of South America, where this is actually the data at low pass filtered at 2 seconds. This is actually, if you notice here, you can't actually see the actual arrival in the data, which is very common when we're looking for these phases. And this is actually a vespagram. It didn't come out very well, but around here you'll see little small black lines, and those are actually the 95% confidence interval. So when I'm choosing these phases, I'm looking at all these stacks, all the 4 different methods, and then looking and saying, okay, is this consistent? Is it 95%? Do I have 95% confidence? And can I see, is there an actual amount of power there? Basically, you can ignore the numbers. You can think blue is very low power, not much signal. Red is you have a very strong signal. I'm going to be showing only the nth root stack today. I do have the other phases as well. Again, in this one, I find, which is interesting, what we're actually looking at, we have something at 830 and then something at 1120. So we have 2 SDP phases, which we've identified by time and slowness. Again, and this is another example. Again, from this is around in the center of the South America, right where you have the kink. And we do have, this one's not as pretty, but it looks like we do have something at 920 and 1120. Now, this is also, again, the data at two low past 2 seconds. Now, this is actually for the same event, but this is recorded by the Southern California Seismic Network. But if you look at this one, we only see something really at maybe 1020. And this is actually, I explained this is, if you look, this is 6. This is the actual earthquake. The Southern California Network is sampling up here, and Capovolo is actually sampling down here. So we're actually sampling 2 different points. So it doesn't worry me as much that I'm not getting the exact same number. And again, just another example. I'm just going to toss a bunch of examples at you. This is actually from the Ristra array, and this is the data. It has a wonderful signal-to-noise ratio, which is very useful in this. So we do actually see something at 810 and then maybe at 1120 and then something at 1460 kilometers depth. And these three do all appear in both the phase weight, the linear, and the nth root phase weight stacks. So that's how I know that they're probably consistently there. And actually, let me go back. Where is that? Oh. Actually, if you look at this one here, I just want to point out as an example that this one here I did not include as a phase. And you look here and say, oh, it's yellow and high something. However, there's no 95% confidence interval, so it's just an artifact of the stacking process in really. So in general, I'm just going to toss up my results. Basically, right now, I'll be making a cross-section and map. I didn't want to show you a large table. We do see some reflectors at 830 to 980 kilometers depth, 1020 to 1150 kilometers depth, and deeper scatters between 1460 and 1500 kilometers depth. Basically, what future venues are going to is we want to confirm these observations. So we're going to look at other phases like SDS and SS to help confirm that we're actually seeing as real. And also basically how these scatters are associated in depth with the high velocity anomaly. And hopefully what I would like to do is actually get a better tremographic model for South America regionally. So I could say, is this associated with the high velocity anomaly or not? And we're going to leave that at that and open up for questions.
Can you explain to me, what does the density of the yellow mean?
It's basically mean it's the strength of, like, basically when we stack, it's basically the P wave amplitude is, like, you have the, they basically think of, the easiest way to explain it is here means I have a much stronger signal. Like, if you look at the stacks, if the amplitude is higher.
What I'm trying to get at is why is there not really a difference in the strength between, say, the 14 and your 10 and 20?
1020, these are nth root stacks. Part of what an nth root stack does, it takes from amplitude and evens it out, so it makes it more of a phase coherence. If I looked at this at a linear stack, like you can probably pick out slightly more differences, and part of it's just the way the color bar is. If seismologists, we can play with color bars all we want, which is why the 95% color interval is important.
I think the question was another stack where you had something close to zero slowness, but then there was something
which
that was away from the zero slowness, which seemed odd. I guess it's this one.
This one here?
Well, actually, I was looking at this one below, there at minus one and a half.
Minus one and a half?
Well, to the right. It looks very sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Farther to the right.
Farther, this one here? Yeah.
Because it's just under the other one. And so mm-hmm. It seems, so why would you label?
Basically, because I was.
And not the other.
All right. This one I was able to, because I was actually interested in that phase. I actually did this two or three nights ago and just only labeled the phases I was interested in. And I have to look at the stack, but I'm not sure this one has a 95% confidence interval around it. But right now I've been going through, I basically been only identifying the phases I'm interested in right now, but I can go back and identify, I probably need to go back and identify this phase here and a few others.
So you're basically looking at
we're looking at flat, yes.
Or converter or whatever, flat horizons.
Mm-hmm.
But people talked, and there have been a number of papers, I guess, where they think that they see some fragments of slabs.
Mm-hmm.
But in that case, they can have any angle of reflection or scatter. So you're not looking at that.
No, we're not right now. Right now, we're looking at pretty much because the way what we are reassuming that we're looking at when we hit something is going to be a flat interface.
Do we always check the focal mechanisms that there is?
Yes, we do check the focal mechanisms.
Then I'm surprised that in this stack. Mm-hmm. There is no conversion from 400.
Sure.
I don't see it.
Yeah, I didn't see it
which
either.
Is strong, this
yeah, which was.
But the energy is there. Yeah. That's a good radiation.
Yeah, I believe this one it is a good energy. So. This one is actually also pretty far away epicentral distance wise.
Theoretical slowness for this signals is the same as for S, or
The theoretical slowness we calculated using ISAP 91. So it's in this case they were actually fairly close to the P wave. They're just a little slightly negative.
How do you calculate these confidence intervals?
Okay, when I do a bootstrap resampling, is every time I do a stack for a slowness, say like at negative 0.5, I will stack that multiple times, each time just using like maybe 60% of the size of the seismograms, and stack those. So at the end, I can get an average for that slowness and a standard deviation, and then you calculate two standard deviations.
Are these uniquely identified in terms of what they do?
These here, the slowness?
Not necessarily just this example, but all of them.
I would say it is. It's basically, the reason we chose to use the earthquakes and the way we do is basically because you would only expect to see these types of phases between the P and the PP arrival, or the PCP arrival, depending on the epicentral distance from these deep earthquakes to these seismograms. Then we should also see that those are the only phases that should be showing up there. And if they do show up, they'd have a very different slowness. So you can uniquely say, it's because of the slowness and the time, I'm looking at this phase. What was that?
Source and function?
Sorry. For the earthquake,
for this
honest answer, I haven't looked at that. So I haven't looked at that, all the source time functions. We've just been to check the amplitudes. Like when I'm running these as a shell, we do actually run through a check and say what kind of amplitudes would we expect from this S660P. And then we know, can actually have a cutoff saying if it's much smaller than this, we can't really say it's anything.
Thank you very much.